WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Although much of the Gulf region opposes American intervention in Iraq, the Kurds in northern Iraq are hoping the Americans will succeed in ending the regime of Saddam Hussein, and their troops, known as the Peshmerga, want to play a leading role in getting him out. My guest journalist Robin Wright spent 2 weeks in Kurdistan this month, where she interviewed the leaders of the two Kurd factions. She also spent a week in Iran. We're going to talk with her about her observations of both places. Wright is the chief diplomatic correspondent of the Los Angeles Times. She's reported from over 130 countries for CBS News, The Washington Post, and The Sunday Times of London. She's covered 9 wars and reported for 5 years from the Middle East. She's also the author of Sacred Rage, The Wrath of Militant Islam. The Kurds are the largest ethnic group without their own state. They have autonomy in Kurdistan, northern Iraq, where they are protected by U.S. and British planes that patrol the no-fly zone. I asked Robin Wright what kind of help the U.S. is hoping for from the Kurds.
Well, the United States actually faces a dilemma. The Peshmerga forces in northern Kurdistan are the only troops that might be used like the Northern Alliance was in Afghanistan. But the Turks are very nervous about this. And of course, Turkey is the friendliest border for the United States as it looks at where it could launch an invasion. There's virtually no other country on Iraq's perimeter that really wants the United States or would even tolerate the United States using their turf to launch a military assault.
Why is Turkey afraid of that? What would it mean for Turkey?
Turkey has its own Kurdish problem. In fact, it's the single largest security issue inside Turkey. And there's deep fear that if Iraq's Kurds actually gain control of an area in the north legally and has access to Iraq's oil wealth in the north, that it would create a very strong Kurdish entity that could, in fact, help Kurds elsewhere, perhaps get their autonomy inside Turkey or neighboring Syria and Iran, where there are also strong Kurdish populations, or somewhere down the road even fight for a greater Kurdistan. Now, I don't think that's going to happen. I think something very interesting has happened inside Iraq over the past decade. The Kurds have recognized that there are limitations to the state they have created, or the statelet they've created. And the majority of Kurdish leaders I talked to were very adamant about recognizing that their future now lies not with Kurds in neighboring countries, but actually in Baghdad. They really talk quite genuinely today about creating a post-Saddam regime that includes Shiite Muslims in Iraq south, Sunni Muslims in the center of Iraq, and Kurds in the north together. Now, they do want a great deal of autonomy, but they want it in context of Iraq.
So they don't want to secede from Iraq.
The Kurds today don't want to secede from Iraq. I had one of the Kurdish leaders explain to me that the future of the world is globalization, not the creation of new mini-states that are not functional, that can't compete economically or politically.
Now, there are two factions in the Kurds in northern Iraq. You spoke with the leaders of each of those factions. What is the split between them about?
The two dominant groups in the north are the Patriotic Union of Kurdistan, led by Jalal Talabani, and the Kurdish Democratic Party, led by Masoud Barzani. The two men are long-standing rivals and in the mid-1990s actually fought a mini-civil war in the north. Tragically, it was not over ideology, but actually over issues like splitting revenues from the taxation of smugglers moving in and out of their territory, which is their had been one of their primary sources of income, as well as control of land. In 1998, the United States mediated a resolution of this conflict and began a process of confidence-building measures. What's really made the timing of the Kurdish issue so interesting is that after years or decades even of tension and rivalry, they reopened their joint National Assembly just last month, and the two of them are in France this week to talk together with European authorities about the future of Iraq. And both of them talk, I think, quite genuinely today about recognizing that their future in Iraq will depend on their own unity, and that the Kurdish people will be the first to suffer if the rivalry is allowed to continue.
You interviewed Masoud Barzani, one of the leaders of the Kurds in northern Iraq. His father was also a Kurdish leader. Who was his father?
Mustafa Barzani launched the Kurdish nationalist movement in the 1960s and launched the Peshmerga, the fighting force that has been a bane to Saddam Hussein through the 60s, 70s, and 80s. He was the one who mediated the first deal with the United States to get involved in Kurdistan against Saddam Hussein and his cronies in power. Unfortunately, the United States in 1975 abruptly ended its support of the Kurds in negotiating a deal between Iran and Iraq, and tens of thousands of Kurds died when Saddam Hussein, then vice president of Iraq, launched an offensive that put the Kurds down. He subsequently died in exile. The movement was inherited by his son, Masoud Barzani, and the Barzani clan is one of the most powerful and wealthy in northern Iraq. And Barzani is today a representative of the kind of tribal power that still exists in northern Kurdistan. And he is quite noteworthy as a symbol of the Kurds because he still wears the baggy pants and the tightly wound turban of the Kurds.
How much does that memory of American betrayal from 1975 linger in the mind of Masoud Barzani now? Does he distrust the United States because of the way they turned against the Kurds in 1975 when his father was the leader?
The Kurds in general are very suspicious of U.S. involvement in Iraq because of repeated betrayal by the United States, not only in 1975. In 1991, then-President George Herbert Walker Bush called for an uprising by the Kurds against Saddam Hussein after the Gulf War ended. The Kurds did just that. But the United States allowed Saddam Hussein to use his helicopter gunships, and the subsequent military assault on the north led more than a million Kurds to flee to the borders with Iran and Turkey. And the Kurds feel that they were really betrayed, that they did what the United States asked, and the United States allowed them to be beaten again at the cost of thousands of Kurdish lives. I think both Kurdish leaders believe that the United States is its only potential friend, but there is still deep suspicion. And as a result, they're asking for guarantees, specifically that the United States will act militarily if Saddam Hussein should move against the north again, as he did in 1996, in a kind of preemptive strike, perhaps to throw the world off course, doing something that would surprise and disrupt the kind of pattern that everyone foresees unfolding over the next few weeks and months over the weapons inspections.
The Kurds have been able to have their own statelet, as you call it, in northern Iraq because that area has been patrolled by the United States and England. It's a no-fly zone, and they prevent Iraqi planes from flying there and attacking the Kurds. So how much loyalty do the Kurds have to the United States and England because of their patrol of that no-fly zone?
Kurdistan now thrives as a little statelet, in part because of the no-fly zone by Britain and the United States, but it owes even more to the United Nations for the Oil for Food program, which was launched in 1996 and now allows Kurds, for the first time in their history, really, to get a large or proportionate share of Iraq's oil revenues. Under Oil for Food, all of Saddam Hussein's oil revenues are channeled through the United Nations back into the country. And so the Kurds have a source of income, which they've used very cleverly to build schools, universities, health centers, to pave roads, to reforest the northern area to promote agriculture in the richest agricultural area of the country. It has flourished in ways that are in many ways unimaginable in other parts of the Arab world and even the Islamic world. It's allowed them to open up society so that there are internet cafes everywhere and satellite dishes that perch atop, you know, mud brick roofs in the countryside and dangle with laundry off little balconies in apartment blocks in the cities. They've brought in the outside world and they've created access for Kurds in exchange to communicate with the outside world, even though there's no postal system in the country. So the United Nations and the U.S. have played a critical role, but the Kurds really deserve an awful lot of credit for rebuilding themselves. Saddam Hussein pulled out his administration in 1991 in large part to starve the Kurds. He thought that living under an embargo, not only from the United Nations, which still applies, and from Iraq at the same time, would so isolate this landlocked community that they would effectively succumb. And instead, they've thrived.
You just got back from Kurdistan. I'm wondering about the reaction you got as an American or as an American woman.
It was very refreshing being an American in the Middle East, because this may be the only area of all of the Arab world or the Middle East where Americans are really welcome and adored, and the Kurdish leaders and the Kurdish people all talk about waiting for the Americans to come in full force.
You also got back recently from Iran. Did you feel welcomed in Iran?
Well, as an American, I think there is much more tension in a place like Iran. I went, for example, on November 4th to the anniversary of the takeover of the American embassy 23 years ago. And people still get out on the streets in front of the American embassy compound and shout "Death to America," that famous slogan from the takeover in 1979 when 52 Americans were held for 444 days. At the same time, there's been a recent poll in Iran that showed that over 65% of Iranians are ready to renew relations with the United States. The poll was so contentious and controversial that the pollster was arrested and is still in jail in Iran.
My guest is Robin Wright, chief diplomatic correspondent of the Los Angeles Times and author of the book Sacred Rage, The Wrath of Militant Islam. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Robin Wright, chief diplomatic correspondent for the LA Times. This month, she spent 2 weeks in northern Iraq and 1 week in Iran. She observed the student protests in Iran calling for freedom of speech and political reform. The specific focus has been the death sentence of a popular history professor who was challenging the hardline clergy and the fundamentalist interpretation of Islam. After we recorded our interview yesterday, several student leaders were arrested and the government forbade further demonstrations defending the professor. Wright told us today that she thinks the students will continue to fight for reforms.
The student movement in Iran today is emerging kind of as a third force. Politics traditionally have been defined by the hardline religious clerics who have effective veto power over Iran's political system, and then the reformists who emerged in 1997 with the election of President Khatami and have since won elections in parliament as well as the municipal councils, and really are the strongest political force in Iran today, but don't have the powers needed to put forth those reforms. And the emergence of the students who are reformers and want to see President Khatami succeed are beginning to break away and say that while they support the reformers, they believe that after 5 years of inaction, it's time to move on. And what makes them so interesting is, unlike the demonstrations 3 years ago, students are today not looking for confrontation. They're engaged in peaceful civil disobedience. And their numbers, however, are so large on almost every campus in Iran that they are engaging in what is the biggest movement since the 1979 revolution.
One of the things that's so interesting about that is that it was students who were so behind the revolution in 1979 that put fundamentalists in power, and now it's students who are challenging fundamentalism.
Iran's political story today is largely about demographics. The vast majority of the population, something like two-thirds, is under 25, some even say under 20, and they have no memory of the monarchy that prevailed in Iran for 2,500 years and the protests and anger that led people to take to the streets to oust it. Today, they are plugged into the internet. They get satellite television that brings in CNN and the BBC, and as well as MTV and American soap operas, and they understand what's happening in the rest of the world, and they want very much to be a part of it.
Did you speak to any of the students who are at the forefront of this new movement?
Well, it was very interesting because I went out on November 4th with the students who had been bussed in to demonstrate against the Americans, and I interviewed some of the young people, and many of them were
This was the Death to America anniversary celebration.
That's right. Yeah. And they were quite annoyed that they had been forced to come down to the American embassy. Again, they don't remember the takeover of the embassy, and it's not an important historic moment in their eyes. Then later, I went out to the student demonstrations, and this is where you found the kids really engaged, talking about the issues. And it was quite interesting to watch many of the professors also boycotting classes on the day that the demonstration was on that particular campus. And as I said, it moved around. But the students on campuses, not only in the capital, Tehran, but at more than a half dozen other major universities in other cities in Iran.
Now, this is happening at a time, you know, just a few months after President Bush named Iran as part of the Axis of Evil. So I wonder if you have a sense of how the students who were protesting the extremist cleric leadership of Iran, how they feel about what Bush said about Iran.
President Bush's speech in the State of the Union address, calling Iran one of three countries in the Axis of Evil, I think backfired against the United States inside Iran. This is a country where after the 9/11 attacks, people took to the streets in candlelight vigils, and there was an enormous sympathy with the United States that some of the reformists actually thought they could channel into reviving the overtures or the effort to renew relations between the two countries. Instead, this led to an enormous backlash among young people as well as among conservatives, and played into the hardliners' argument that the United States was still out to get the regime, that it was not possible to bridge the deep chasm between the two countries.
What's the place of religion in the lives of the students who are protesting against the government and the clerics?
The role of religion in Iran today is really in a private capacity. You've seen an enormous transformation since the 1979 revolution, when people actively wore their religion on their sleeves, literally, and women's dress and men's beards. It was a visible part of culture. Today, you see young men, the vast majority of whom are clean-shaven. They are saying, in effect, there's not just one way. There are multiple ways to lead a good Muslim's life, and that is, in many ways, the seed for democracy, the kind of thinking that it's not one authoritative path to the implementation of Islam. I think what you're seeing as well is people saying, we don't want a counter-revolution. Iranians don't have the energy or the interest in seeing more bloodshed, not only because of their own revolution, but also because of its 8-year war with Iraq. What people are saying today is they want to see the Islamic Republic become more of a republic in which Islam is part of an individual's private life.
How were the students dressed who were protesting? I'm interested particularly in the women students.
Women's dress has really undergone a major transformation. I remember in the early days of the revolution when I flew in and had very light pink nail polish on, and that was banned. I had to put 10 Band-Aids on my fingers to cover up the color I'd put on my nails, even though it was barely visible. Today, young students wear not only a lot of makeup, but bright red nail polish, and they no longer even wear black stockings. You'll see girls in sandals with bright red toenails. And young women wear very, very short kind of coats that instead of the long chadors, body-enveloping black chadors, or the total cover in scarves and baggy coats that young students wore. You see them in blue jeans, high heels, without black stockings, very short, you know, jackets. And their sleeves rolled up. So the scarves on their heads are pushed back, so you see a lot of hair. There is much more of a gradual, it's a gradual transition, but women are wearing things very differently than they did 20 years ago.
Can you sense a big generation gap within families?
Students today, or young people, are taking the lead in Iran politically. And I think the interesting thing is that their parents, in many ways, are following suit. There is a generation gap politically among those in power and Iran's young people. But within families, I think you find a lot of parents thinking that their kids are creating the kind of future they'd like to see in Iran, too.
Robin Wright is the chief diplomatic correspondent for the LA Times and author of the book Sacred Rage, The Wrath of Militant Islam. She'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Let's get back to our interview with Robin Wright, chief diplomatic correspondent for the LA Times and author of the book Sacred Rage, The Wrath of Militant Islam. Earlier this month, she spent 2 weeks in northern Iraq and a week in Iran. Having spent a week in Iran, what do you think Iran's position will be if we do go to war with Iraq?
I think the Iranians have concluded that this is something that is going to happen. Saddam Hussein, one way or another, is going to be removed from power. They're much more interested in the question of how it happens and how long it takes, and secondly, what comes next. There is, I think, a willingness to play the same kind of role that Tehran did in the 1991 Gulf War and with Afghanistan, basically standing on the sidelines, offering to provide search and rescue services if American pilots are shot down. If the war is short and conclusive, but if the war or if a military operation becomes prolonged, a lot of civilians are killed, and it becomes messy in terms of conclusion, I suspect you will see the Iranians, like much of the Islamic world, condemning the United States, being critical of its and suspicious of its long-term intentions. But I do know that the Americans have also sent through messages to the regime to say, first, that the United States hopes to be there quite briefly, and that politically it hopes to move aside very soon after ousting Saddam Hussein, if it comes to that, because weapons inspections fail. And secondly, it hopes that Iran will play the role it did in 1991 in standing aside.
So do you think Iran will actually assist the United States if there's war with Iraq?
The important Iranian role really comes after the fall of Saddam Hussein. Iran has supported one of the most active Shiite Muslim groups in opposition to Saddam Hussein, the Supreme Council for the Islamic Revolution in Iraq. And Iran has a very strong interest in seeing Shiite Muslims represented in a new government because they make up the largest sector of Iraqi society, probably 60% or more of the population. But ironically, 20 years after its own Islamic revolution, Iran wants very much to see a stable regime in Baghdad that has no aggressive intentions against its neighbors. And to do that, Iranians believe, and this is true of the government, that the best solution is one that reflects all three sectors of society and is not predominantly Shiite. And I think that's a turning point in Iran politically.
It's so interesting, you know, the United States backed Iraq in its war against Iran, and now it looks like we're going to be going to war with Iraq, and we're hoping for some backing from Iran. Is that the kind of irony you feel when you're traveling through that area?
Yeah, but that's a complicated question. Iranians feel very bitter about the United States' role in confronting Saddam Hussein, in part because they so wanted American help against Saddam's invasion after 1980. They point out that Iran suffered the highest loss of victims to chemical weapons. According to the CIA, at least 50,000 Iranians died from Iraq's use of chemical weapons, particularly mustard gas. And I toured many of the hospitals where these people are still dying. And over the last 5 years, Iran has discovered a second wave of victims, people who had low-dose exposure and had no idea that they had come into contact, and now they have begun to die. And a pulmonary specialist said that medical teams now dealing with this believe they may have only reached the tip of the iceberg, that there may be thousands more who show up now and years down the road, and that it's also created a real problem with birth defects among a second generation people, children of those who came in contact with chemical weapons in the 1980s. And Iranians point out that this was that Iraq's most frequent usage of chemical weapons was after the United States became involved in helping Saddam Hussein with satellite intelligence, pointing out where Iranian troops were, and then Saddam Hussein used chemical weapons against them. And so the Iranians feel that the United States has some culpability in the deaths of its people by chemical weapons, and now, of course, is going into Iraq because of the same issue.
What are some of the long-term health effects that you saw now in Iran, results of the chemical weapons attacks?
A death by chemical weapon is one of the grisliest deaths. People I saw look like concentration camp visitors, you know, with toothpick bones, skin tightly wrapped around it. People with severe respiratory problems, gasping for breath. Many of them recalled only the smell of roses or garlic or freshly mown lawn, which are the telltale signs of mustard gas. Some of them have memories that are equivalent to an early Alzheimer's patient. They have blisters and deep scarring of their skin, particularly around areas that perspire, under the arms and elsewhere. And the skin is deeply discolored and blistered. It's teeth fall out so that people have to eat with only their gums if they can eat at all. Weight loss. I interviewed one fellow who is 33 years old, and he dropped more than half of his weight. Today only weighs 107 pounds. The doctor said he probably had less than 6 months. I interviewed some people who probably are not alive now because death was so imminent.
Having witnessed the terrible long-term effects of the chemical weapons, long-term effects on those lucky enough to have survived this long after the attacks, would it affect your willingness to go to the area and cover a war if there is a war with Iraq?
Well, it certainly makes you think twice. And it's one of the reasons the Kurds have asked of the United States gas masks and medical facilities to deal with chemical weapons if Saddam Hussein should use them again against the Kurds. I do know that many of the correspondents who are going to that area are taking training in nuclear, biological, and chemical fallout and taking gas masks and special medical supplies with them. This, in many ways, could be the most dangerous war for journalists as well as troops, because of the issue of weapons of mass destruction.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Robin Wright is the chief diplomatic correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. This is Fresh Air.